Hi, thanks for listening to Bow Ties in Business. Today, we're going to talk about a journey from what was this going to be the C-suite and international roles of a multinational corporation to, frankly, running your own business in the world of finance and mortgage. With that, I'm joined by Liam Leonard. We're going to really just have an open conversation today. So if you're running a business, you know, have started a business or are in some point in your career, and we might even talk a little bit about career changes for people that are midstream, stay tuned. If you want to learn more about Liam and what he does, it's dmlcap.com. And with that, thanks for being here today.
Thanks, Tim. Happy to be here and look forward to the conversation.
And you had me on your show, so if you don't mind, plug your show a little bit as an opener. How about that?
Sounds good. So I also run a show called The Prosperity Perspective. We're focused on having conversations with successful business owners and understanding how they protect their wealth, what they do today to continue to preserve that. And then also looking back to see, you know, what they did earlier in their careers as they were becoming successful and what advice they have for other business owners who might be going through that journey as well.
So I absolutely loved our conversation there, and I'm so excited for today. But if you're listening, definitely go check it out. So let's talk about your background. Started in a different field of business than mine, but you worked internationally, and you had, you know, you were on the fast track, and you decided to change courses. So can you give a little bit of a setup and background there?
I can. So my background, although I look very white and very typical American, heritage is actually Chinese. And so my dad was born and raised in Hong Kong. I bring that up because my upbringing was very much a tiger mom type environment. And I was raised to succeed from the very beginning, and nothing but the best was sufficient. And so that led me on a course of, you know, excelling in school, excelling in academics, continuing to push for success and greater achievement as a condition for kind of why I was here. And so as I grew up, I learned Spanish, wanted to learn Chinese to tie it to my heritage. And so I speak both those languages today. Reading and writing on the Chinese side, not as good as what it used to be. Memory is definitely fading, and when you don't use it every day. But so that led me on a course where I went to Yale. I studied economics at Yale. I played soccer while I was there. While I was at Yale, I did an international, two international stints. One I went and I lived over in Spain. I lived in Sevilla. I worked to essentially uncover trade opportunities between Spain and China. So got to leverage some of my background and affinities for those countries for a private investor group. And then the year after that, I went and lived in China. I was studying at Beida. So for those of you who know Beida or Peking University, essentially it's the Ivy League of China, because my parents would have nothing less than that. And so I got to play soccer over there, go to school over there as well. And so kind of an experience. But for me, the international culture was always something that was very important. And I wove in to my career. Coming out of college, I joined Nestle. So, you know, largest food and beverage company in the world. Doesn't get much more corporate than Nestle. And part of why I did that and what I loved about them was they had the international presence and they had expats and they encouraged you living abroad and, you know, taking in that journey. And so with them, I actually got to go down. I worked in Mexico City for a while. I worked in Sao Paulo for a while. I worked in Lima for a while and kind of got to leverage kind of the benefits of that big company. and really sent me on this path of how do I go and become a CEO of a multinational company. And so, you know, from early in college, that was kind of my goal. I knew I wanted to run a company. I knew my personality was one that I'm much better when I'm in charge. I don't do well taking direction that I don't believe in. And so there were some challenges along my journey that definitely questioned some of that. But from a background perspective, that's kind of essentially what I was bred to do, was to go run a big company, and was well on my way to doing that.
So what made you step away? Because that is a hell of a trajectory to come from.
Yeah. So to kind of continue, after I joined Nestle, I started in the operations procurement department. And so I was negotiating media and advertising contracts. From there, I went into marketing. From Nestle, I went and I worked for Pepsi as part of their innovation unit. And I worked in marketing for their innovation unit. From there, I joined, I got my MBA on the side from Anderson in finance, international studies. And I also got a little real estate finance component, because that was something I envisioned I would build in my personal portfolio while I was doing this other international thing. And so after graduation, I went and I joined T-Mobile in essentially an executive development program. They sent me to run a call center in Colorado Springs, and then I ran sales for Sacramento and Utah, and then I went up to headquarters and ran a big portion of the accessories business, right? So I bring those experiences up because my trajectory was all about how do I gain experience in different functions so I could be the best CEO possible, right? Understand how these different components worked. And was, to your point, Tim, I was on a very good track and moving very quickly. What made me leave was I realized, and it was tough, I switched jobs every 9 to 12 months, right? So all of those jobs that I just articulated happened in probably a 4 to 5 year window of kind of those movements and different responsibilities. And so this rapid learning is one thing that I learn, one thing that I cherish personally, right, as a value. However, what I realized was I was substituting that ability to learn for being unhappy in the environment. And so there were a couple of realizations that I had. One was in a corporate structure, how you make the corporation work efficiently is really to have a bunch of cogs that make the machine run. If you have someone who's underperforming and doesn't carry their weight, that's a bad thing because the machine doesn't operate effectively. But what people often don't recognize is that if you overperform and you push against the machine to be more efficient or do things differently, that's also a bad thing because it challenges the machine and the machine doesn't operate smoothly. And so I would get into these situations where I would, again, going back to my personality, I would push and strive to make things better. And I was often met with heavy resistance because it's not the way we do things, or that would take too long, or, you know, that would sacrifice short-term, you know, profitability or ability to hit a short-term goal, even though it might be better in the long run. And so missing the short-term goal meant people miss bonuses, and so it has a financial impact, right? So there's a disincentive to kind of working outside of the machine. And so I came up with this I wrote it on a sticky note one day, and it sits on my screen, and it essentially says, everyone is replaceable. And in the corporate structure, that's truer than most, where it's designed to kind of swap people in and out, and that ability to keep things on a steady continual growth. So I think that was one. I think the other component was I was getting really tired of the amount of time and effort that it took to position yourself for the next promotion or the next role, which essentially boils down to politics, right? But you've got to spend a lot of time building the right relationships, having the right support structure from people who are in higher positions to help pull you through, help showcase your work, right? Get put on special projects, and just spending an inordinate amount of time to try to get those things to position myself for success, that either didn't correlate, right? Or it was just a lot of added effort that didn't directly, for me, relate to the direction that we were trying to go, right? And that got complicated when you ran into someone who then felt threatened, who was above you, right? And then might, you know, give you a project, but then simultaneously try to undermine that project so you're not successful. And then you're working twice as hard, right? Because then you've got to have an even deeper network to overcome, right? An executive who's in that role that doesn't support you. And then you've got to execute when they don't give you the resources you need to be able to execute. And I just got tired of the BS, quite frankly. So that was the second thing. The third thing was I felt more and more disconnected from the community. And being able to help and support the community in a meaningful way. And so what I mean by that is, you know, all those organizations have large commitments to the communities and how they serve them and give back. But those activities are largely held by a small group of people within a function whose role is managing those community relations. Whereas for me, and I look at my dad, who eventually went and ran his own company as well, he's a pillar in the community, right? So he sits on a lot of nonprofit boards, right? He's out and about in different events. He's helping enrich people's lives. And I didn't feel like I had that purpose, and it wasn't satiating that for me in the roles that I was having. The last role that I had with T-Mobile was in an accessories role where we were able to boost the numbers. And we did that through extending lines of credit to low income, low qualified borrowers to buy accessories that bluntly they didn't need, right? Like, why does a family of six need a $300 speaker that we're then going to put on credit and, you know, factor in a loss, right? And it was propelling this never-ending consumerism in my mind that I've got an economics degree and a finance degree, right? So capitalist at heart, and I love the free market, but this never-ending search for more, more, more is categorically juxtaposed to my moral values. And so the ability to kind of take a step back and say, I don't know if this is the best thing for these people, right? Like, there's so many better things they could be doing with their money. So that, you know, wanting to be involved and actually, you know, help people it was a big driver. The straw that broke the camel's back is they eventually, my next role was going to be either in Cleveland or Baltimore, and that just wasn't a place that I was willing to go. And so I had been thinking about all these other things, and with that one coming in, it was like, okay, it's time to go and let's get off the hamster wheel and let's try something different. And so that's when I really made the decision that, you know, chasing this never-ending promotion for more and more work and less time with the family and less, you know, ability to be a part of the community was just not a direction I wanted to head anymore. And so I broke away, and best decision I ever made.
So I'm going to ask a couple questions I didn't plan to, because I think a lot of people listening, frankly, have heard about trajectories like you've talked about, but I don't think they understand the impact, right, of what it takes on you as a person, not the business, the not staying in a job for more than 9 months or a year because you're successful, the pressure of relocation, rebuilding your staff, the toll that takes, and, you know, what that does both short term and long term. Do you mind talking a little bit about that?
Yeah. So basically in every new role that I took, you've got a 30-day grace period, so to speak. And in that grace period, you have to win the hearts and minds of all your employees, and you have to align them on whatever your strategic objectives are. Right. And so in order to do that within 30 days, you really got a week, maybe, that you've got to dissect your role and where you're headed to what's the top priority that needs to be accomplished, you know, to move the team forward in a meaningful way. And then you've got to get everyone aligned to why they need to do that, right? Easy to do if it's aligned to what had been done previously, right? Then you're really taking and you're optimizing, right? And you're trying to find, you know, people who can do a little bit more, stretch people, give them, you know, a little more responsibility to have success that way. But more often than not, I was being put in roles that something was wrong, right? Yep. So when you got to go in and fix something, then you've got to change the inertia of the entire team. And so, you know, when I say it takes 7 days, it takes 7 days of 12 to 18 hour days, to be able to get that done. Right. And, then you've got to be able, the working hours you're spending with the team, right? Help me understand what's going on. What do we do today? What are the issues? What works well for you? Trying to keep the things that are working well are the things that the team likes, right? So that you can rally around that, and then breaking off the pieces where there's disconnect and replacing them with new components, right? So to speak, to be able to move forward. And so during the waking hours you're spending with the team, right? You're trying to build a relationship. You're trying to understand what's going on. And then all your real work happens after hours, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the only time you've got the ability to do anything strategic. So at the time, it was just myself and my wife. And there was largely an understanding that, you know, hey, the career trajectory was super important. We were moving all the time. Fortunately, I had someone who was bought in, who understood that, and was aligned to making those sacrifices. What it meant was work was the number one priority, right? Mm-hmm. You're putting in so much time and mental energy that oftentimes you don't have a lot of bandwidth left at the end of the day to give to your significant other, right? Or anything personal in that matter, right? You yeah. try to weave the personal hobbies into the work component wherever possible. Right. And team building events or, you know, things like that. But again, it's all secondary, right? It's a tactic to build relationships. Yep. So that's really tough. And then, I mean, moving every 9 months, physically, right. Most often for us, it was different states, is incredibly stressful. There's never a move where something doesn't break. There's never a move where you move somewhere else and your furniture magically fits the space that you find, right? So, and then you've got the relational component, right? Like you've got to figure out how to create harmony with your significant other and how you live in that, how you build community, right? And that's the other part, like friends largely don't exist because you don't have time. Like, how do you build a friendship when you're working 12 to 18 hour days, and then your spare time is spent trying to build or maintain a relationship with your significant other, right? There's zero sense of community. You try to weave it in with the work piece, right? Where you're taking people out or you're going to happy hours, and but it's stressful and it's lonely. And there's a lot that you take on in terms of that burden, right? And so, it was part of that switch of those things, the three things that I was articulating came when, you know, my wife sat down and she looked at me and she basically said, when is it going to stop? You know, every time you get promoted, you take on more work and it's more stressful.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really change, right? You spend the first month is miserable because you're always working. Months two and three are pretty bad. And then you get into a flow and things are okay. And then we move again. And so like, where on this journey does that change? Right. Cause you don't want to be in a role. Like 2 years was probably the upper limit. Right. And
yeah, cause you're stuck after that. Let's be honest. If you've done it for more than 2 years and you haven't grown your org or your span of control, you're done. Cold, but true.
Cold, but true. And so, when was it going to stop, right? That was her question to me. And we were starting to think about kids, right? And so then you start thinking about kids and you start thinking about, you know, what's the life that your kid is going to have? Can you imagine a kid growing up? Like, put yourself as you in as a kid. Would you want a life where your dad was never there? Right, was only there sparingly, right? And like that just ate at my soul. And it was like, okay, it's not feasible, right? And then you start looking at, I looked at top executives and I looked at, you know, what does their life really look like? They're on planes all the time. They're on the phone all the time. Majority of them have failed relationships of some sort or multiple failed relationships, right? It's just not a priority. It comes second, right? And at a certain point in time, it's going to create a conflict, right? Because how do you tell your wife that you're second all the time? Like,
yeah, and by the way, that goes over poorly.
Don't recommend it, right?
So, yeah, telling your partner that they come behind work is a recipe for disaster, I can say firsthand.
Yeah. So, you know, short term, sure, you can get some buy-in, right? But after 5 years of that, basically the conversation was enough or is enough.
Yep.
And you basically had to choose, right? Like, what do you value more? Do you value being that, you know, C-suite executive that pushes and has the power, has the control, has the title, has the ego, right? All of those things that I was, again, bred to fill that position, right? Yeah. Or do you take a step back and you say, you know, hey, life is short and there's more to it than me being successful in the business world and filling that role. And there's plenty of other ways that I can be successful and have a more fulfilling life. And so that realization didn't happen overnight, right? That's probably a 2 to 3 year journey and a battle with myself. And the most difficult part was probably going back to my parents to say, I'm going in a different direction, right? And to them, right, particularly my father, to tell him I'm leaving a successful job where I'm super well compensated and everything is taken care of, where there's no concerns about the family. And in my case was to figure something out or start something new was like, you're doing what? Like, why are you doing that? Are you sure? Right. And just, you know, seeds of doubt that get planted immediately. Right. And it's all about self-preservation, right. From my father's perspective, right. And making sure that I can be successful in the future. But, that conversation was really tough.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's interesting because I had a different path and I worked for small companies and had a history of M&A, right. So you got acquired, you had to rebuild, you had your 7 days, you had to do it before due diligence even started to make sure you had a chair. And then you were doing it to somebody else as you grew, right? And that life on a plane, that fast track, that rocket ship that you see in movies, they never show the toll that you just described.
Yeah.
And by the way, I am the worst guy at work-life balance. You ask my partner, I am horrendous. And, you know, and for me, it's been a 2-year journey to not work 20 hours a day. Mm-hmm. Right. Cause I don't know about you. You made a comment about friends. One of the things I realized is I lived in St. Louis now for 18 years. I probably have 3 friends in the city. I have more friends in Seattle, New York, and London than I will ever have here because that's where my business life's for.
Yep. Yeah. It makes perfect sense. Right. I'm fortunate that my wife has pulled me into some of her social circles, right? Mm-hmm. And having kids is a great way to expand that yeah. network, right? And so fortunate that helped us jumpstart some things and then, you know, expanding beyond that. But we had to be very deliberate about building a social network, right? Because you don't have time to just go hang out and see who you meet, right? Like it's okay. We're going to, for us, it was going to church, right? We need to make sure we're plugged into a church community.
Yep.
And there's a whole network of people there that, you know, doesn't typically interface. For me, I get my, I hate, I hate working out on my own. And so for me to get exercise was always through sports. And so for me, it was how do I plug into that community of people and build a network of friends there, right? And so through a couple deliberate actions, right, you start to build some networks of some friends. But if we didn't sit down and say, hey, this is really important, it never would have gotten done, right? That space and time would have gotten filled with what comes next on the job front and how do we, you know, how do we progress? And there's tension, right? Like when you're not available on a Sunday to bang something out for an executive meeting on a Monday because, you know, you're going to church or spending time with friends or whatever, like,
They don't understand. They don't understand that you're all in.
You're all in, and you're all in all the time, right? Yeah. And if you're not, that track is just—it's typically not for you.
Yeah, yeah. Now you escaped. How's it feel?
liberating is the best word. And I'm still discovering this, right? A lot of mental shackles that I put on myself. In terms of like, hey, this is the way it needs to be. This is the only path. You need to be successful here. And that's like, wait a second. Like, there's so many other ways to be successful, right? And to fulfill, to have purpose and to have meaning and to explore happiness, right? And so a lot of big things there, right? But when you start, you know, sitting down and thinking about it, right, there's plenty of studies that, you know, once you reach a certain income level, the increased income above that does not actually impact happiness in any meaningful way. Right. And it's like okay so if you're not going to get happier by getting more money, and you acknowledge that there's a quote-unquote plateau, right, to that financial component, then it just frees you, right? Like, you're not chasing stuff to go and, you know, get a promotion to earn more money because you think you need more money to go do X, Y, Z. It's a, hey, I'm happy and I'm content and I'd rather not do that so I can go take my family on a vacation or, you know, spend time with friends, right? Whatever those things may be. So super liberating there, right? And then, I mean, the other aspect, now that I own my own business and, you know, we're starting to be successful, is really the impact that I get to have on employees' lives, you know, both mental, physical, right, from a mental health perspective, and the things that we do from a cultural perspective, being able to offer insurance, right, you know, taking care of their livelihoods is super important and something that I'm grateful for, and giving back to the community, right? So we give back, you know, at least 10% of everything we do to charitable organizations. And so most of those are local or smaller organizations that we're plugged into, right? Or and we do serve on the board of some of the larger ones like Boys and Girls Club. But again, all those are local clubs, right? And so to the extent that we can enrich people's lives and help others who don't have the same opportunity that we do, has really become a core focus. And I love that.
And that's really, we talked about friends. That's actually a really interesting way, because my friends in St. Louis, outside of the three that I referenced, were at the yoga studio, right? And yoga was almost ritualistic for me being there, because it was the same people. And in many cases, we had different industries, but we were in the same world, so it connected us, much like your sports did, right? And then serving on boards isn't glorious if you've never done it and you're listening, right? It is not this fantastic thing where they roll up all this great stuff. You're actually doing a lot of the grunt work on a board. Is that fair?
Yep, that's accurate. Yeah. You're essentially a consultant for the company.
Yep.
That's almost always, it depends on the organization, right? But for the ones we work with, pro bono, right?
Yep.
So they're tapping into your knowledge and your expertise, and it's a lot of work, right? Because you're solving strategic initiative then for another company. And if you want to do, I can't do anything half-assed, right? So if something's given to me, I'm going to do it well. And so then it creates effectively a second job, right? For every board that you take on.
Yeah. Yeah, so you cut your work day down to 10 or 12, but now you're on a board, so it's back to 14 to 16.
Yeah.
So you touched on healthcare as a business owner. Big challenge. Actually, it's something I'm dealing with ZPI right now, right, that I'm helping build. And I don't think if you're a business owner, you realize how challenging and how costly healthcare in America really is. And I don't mean to turn this into a political conversation, but with your economics background, right? Thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's fascinating because we set up with all of our employees who came in not to expect healthcare, that we weren't going to be offering benefits, right? Because, you know, as you're ramping a new company, to your point, there's a huge operational and overhead component that you take on, right? Legally, you have to pay a minimum of 50% of employees' healthcare responsibility, right? So whatever an employee is looking at and thinking their healthcare costs are high, the employer is already covering at least half of that. And it's a massive number, right? And you're talking, you know, anywhere from 500 to $1,000 a month per employee that you're adding, you know, just straight costs, right? There's a benefit to the company to having healthy, well-balanced employees for sure, but there's no direct tie to output, right? And so my economics brain, as you're talking about inputs and outputs and, you know, marginal costs of adding things, the marginal benefit of adding healthcare is technically zero, right? So that's one it's an altruistic component essentially that we did to put in place. But I mean, the burden is massive, right? Our employees are mostly commission-based, mm-hmm. right? And they're commission-based, so we don't have to carry an overhead. Mm-hmm. And with healthcare, you're introducing an overhead that, you know, if you have a bad month, it's coming out of, you know, my pocket, just to make sure we can continue to move forward, right? Like, you don't get a pass on healthcare costs, nope. Right? And every year they increase, it's becoming harder and harder, right? And I think there's more and more stress, particularly trying not to get political here, right? But essentially we've entered a bifurcated environment, right? Yeah. Where everyone is being asked to pick sides and everything is very polarizing, right? And so from a healthcare perspective, it's the same, where you've got kind of Obamacare options, which has then increased the cost of the private market because they have fewer subscribers that are on their plans and their network, right? And so the only way they can continue to offer with rising healthcare is to increase rates. And so as an employer, I don't get to go to Obamacare and be like, hey, what's the employer plan? How are we going to make this work? It's a, nope, you got to figure it out on your own, right? And so high costs there that you've got to take on. And the bifurcation, right, either this or that, I think is really bad. I think it's a terrible situation, right? And I think that spills over onto the political side as well, where there's so much more we have in common that we're, as we're focusing on the differences, it's creating division and pitting us against each other, where there's so much more opportunity to work together and find those points of similarity, right? And so I think as an economist, having a state-run program and a free enterprise, right? No market limitations program trying to run simultaneously will never work. Something's going to break at some point in time, and you're going to have to go one way or the other. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But, you know, short term, it's, you know, we're fortunate that the business has been successful, that we have the profitability to cover those expenses. But I mean, every year we forecast it, it's a larger and larger number and bigger component that's it's not easy to take on, particularly as a smaller, medium-sized business.
And there's no predictability, right? You, and if you haven't dealt with it, there's employee age bands and everything. And you know, sometimes you can find a good HR firm that can bring you some level of coverage that's the same price regardless of employee age, right? But in some cases, if your age spend is wide, right, you could have a person in their late 20s who is $750 a month, and for the same quality of care for an individual who's in their late 50s, the company's obligation there could be upwards of $3,000 for them to have 100% coverage. And if you look at the 50% split, you're at $1,500. And that's why you, by the way, if you haven't chosen, that's why you see the buy-up plans and insurers offer that high deductible piece, or at least my opinion on that.
Yep. No, completely agree. Yeah, our employees who are on the upper end of that age bracket are more than double. It's typically between 2 to 3x what a younger employee is, right? And so, I mean, if you start playing that out, right, and you talk about ageism, right?
Yeah.
It's cheaper for me to hire someone younger than someone older, right? And it's like, that shouldn't have to be a consideration. Like that factors in, right? And we try to eliminate that from our hiring practices. But from a finance side, you see it, and it's a real number that you have to be able to manage.
So one last question before we close out. You're on your own. The business is doing well. Talk a little bit about what you do.
Yeah. So at DML Capital, we're essentially a mortgage lender. So anything related with real estate finance, if you need a loan on your primary residence, or you're looking to invest, or you've got a unique situation, we help do all of those loans. We also work with, for those of you who watch HGTV and the fix and flippers, right? And they're talking about, hey, I got this loan at 10% or 9% or 12%. We do those loans as well. And so we work with a group of investors, and then we work with a group of borrowers, right? And so back to the fulfillment and the community piece, we're helping people either put more money in their pocket, or, you know, get into a home of their dreams, or, you know, whatever that may be, which is super fulfilling. And on the investor side, you know, we're helping them preserve for their future and make sure that they've got, you know, their wealth allocation sorted out as well. And so love the space that we're in. I love that it's super local, right? And so we work primarily Washington, California for the more traditional loans. For the fix and flip type loans, we do work nationwide, but focus in California and Washington there. And so that's kind of what we do.
Yeah, finance is a whole separate conversation we didn't get to have today. So we'll have to have you back and talk about the economics of, frankly, your clients and how they look at some point.
Yeah, that'd be fascinating. It's obviously something I love, given my finance background and being able to help people. And that's the most fulfilling piece for me, right? Every client we get to work with, regardless of where they are, they're better off through working with us. And there's nothing better from my perspective than being able to do that for people.
That's great. And I love that you got off the treadmill. Someday I will actually get off it. I've literally had the workaholic conversations a lot lately, but you know, part of it is old shackles, as you said. There is an expectation that you live a certain way, and that is really hard habit to break.
Not easy.
No. Lynn, thanks for being here today.
I appreciate it, Tim. Take care.
You too.